Welcome to Sound Practice, the business podcast for physicians and healthcare leaders, hosted by Mike Tsakopoulos and produced by the American Association for Physician Leadership.
In 1776, Thomas Jefferson wrote, "One of the primary purposes of government was to assist in securing the inalienable right of life for its citizens." Enter public health and public health officers. One of our nation's highest-ranking public health officers is the Surgeon General of the United States. There have been only 21 Surgeons General of the United States. Sound Practice is honored to be speaking about the office and public health with one of them today, the former Surgeon General of the United States, next on Sound Practice. My guest today is Jerome Adams. Dr. Adams served as the 20th Surgeon General of the United States from September 2017 through January of 2021. Prior to that, Dr. Adams was the Health Commissioner of the state of Indiana. Dr. Adams is a board-certified anesthesiologist and holds a master's degree of public health. Jerome Adams, welcome to Sound Practice.
Hey, great to be with you today.
Oh, it is my absolute pleasure. Dr. Adams, as you know, this is the podcast of the American Association for Physician Leadership. Could you describe your path to becoming a physician leader?
Wow. Where to start? I never dreamed of being a physician, much less a physician leader growing up. One of the stories I often tell is that I grew up in a rural community in Southern Maryland, where most people didn't even go to college, much less go on to obtain graduate degrees. The thing that really, I think, pushed me forward, two things actually. One is that both my parents were school teachers and really encouraged me to be involved in STEM programs, so science, technology, engineering, and math. The other thing, ironically, is that I had pretty severe asthma when I was growing up. I almost died on more than one occasion. And what that ended up doing was forcing me to stay inside. I couldn't go outside because of the triggers. Growing up in that rural community, in farms, combines, dust would always trigger my asthma. So I would stay inside and I would study all the time. I'd read. That became kind of my consolation for not being able to go out and play sports. But it also instilled in me a sense of how people don't all have the same opportunities to be successful in life in many ways. I knew that I was never going to be a professional athlete, not because of my lack of ability to hit a baseball or make a free throw, but because I literally was so sick I couldn't go outside and play. I had to be medevaced to Children's Hospital in Washington, D.C. by helicopter one time. That was the first time I ever went to D.C. Because I was in status asthmaticus. They didn't have a pediatrician in my small rural community who was capable of caring for someone with asthma as severe as mine. And so I give all that as a backdrop because it helps, I think, explain the things that I fight for now as a physician leader. And I think it's important when you think about physician leadership to think about who you are and to realize that you've got to be your authentic self. You can't be somebody else. There's many different ways to lead. And for me, a lot of my work has been focused on marginalized populations, underserved communities, really helping be a voice for those who don't always have a voice of their own at the table. Now I'll be really quick in this part, even though this could be another very long story. I went to undergrad actually on an engineering scholarship. I'd never met a doctor who looked like me. Again, this is audio, so for those who aren't aware, I'm an African American male. I grew up in a rural, mostly white community, and never met a black doctor in my entire K through 12 experience, even though I was in the hospital all the time. So I often tell people, you've got to see it to believe that you can be it. And it wasn't that I didn't have the aptitude. I finished second in my high school class, second in my college class. But I just never thought about being a doctor. So I went to school on an engineering scholarship, and I actually went to a talk that was being given by another leader. And I went to it because it was a leadership talk, but it was a talk that was being given by Dr. Ben Carson, the famous African-American male neurosurgeon who was working at Johns Hopkins at the time. And I said, huh, I guess there are Black doctors out there. And it really opened my eyes and changed my entire trajectory. So I switched from engineering into a pre-medical pathway, went to Indiana University for medical school, got involved with the American Medical Association student section. And this is an important part of my story because professional organizations, I think, are an underappreciated training ground, no matter what you decide to go into. And so being involved with the American Medical Association student section exposed me to many other leaders. And I got to study their styles and figure out, okay, here's how you advocate for a particular position effectively. Here's a leadership style that may or may not work for you. And I also got the opportunity to increase my network in the political realm. So we would go to the state house in Indiana. We would go to Washington, D.C. and talk to our legislators. And I met then Congressman Mike Pence. And so nothing happened for about a decade. I continued to lobby. I continued to see Congressman Pence, along with many other folks. Many will remember Larry Bouchon, who was a member of Congress. He became a good friend, other folks like that. Congressman Pence became Governor Pence. And by that point, I was on the Indiana State Medical Association Board of Trustees. And Governor Pence needed someone to run his Indiana State Department of Health. So my name got thrown into the hat. I was somewhat of a known commodity, and I became his health commissioner. And for those who don't remember, that was during Ebola, that was during Zika, that was during a time when we had the largest HIV outbreak related to injection drug use in the history of the United States. That occurred in Scott County, Indiana, another rural community with many marginalized folks. It is amongst the poorest and the least educated communities in Indiana. And we were able to successfully bring the community together, legalize syringe services programs in Indiana, and stop that outbreak. And so that established me as a physician leader on a national scale. And then Governor Pence became Vice President Pence, and my name got thrown into the hat to be Surgeon General. So that's a really abbreviated story of me going from a small, sickly kid in a rural community who never imagined being a physician to being the nation's top doctor.
What a great story. I was going to say American story, but it's a great story in itself, and it's a great American story.
I would agree with you. I think it is a great American story. You know, and you and I, before this conversation, we were talking about some of the elephants in the room. And there's a lot to be concerned about right now in America. But I think we need to remember that we still are blessed to be in this country. So it is a great American story because it's a story that might not have happened in a number of places around the world outside of America. So even as we fight to address many of the challenges that are going on out there right now, I think it behooves us to remember that America is still a unique place, a great place, and that's the reason why we fight for it.
Absolutely. I'm interested in the office of Surgeon General. We all certainly hear the title and occasionally see the Surgeon General on national television. But I'm embarrassed to say that I was not familiar with all the background and the duties and responsibilities. Could you give us the overview of the position of the Surgeon General of the United States?
Absolutely. So first of all, a joke that's not really a joke. When I'm explaining to people what the Surgeon General is and does, the first thing I have to do is tell them I'm neither a surgeon nor a general. So there have been surgeons who have been Surgeons General. C. Everett Koop who many people will remember, was a pediatric surgeon. But the last several surgeons general have not been surgeons. You do have to be a physician to be surgeon general. And the general is actually it's not a rank. It's a title. So surgeon general really means that you're basically the head doctor. It's a military term. And the office of the surgeon general goes back about 200 years. The surgeon general is the head of the Public Health Service Commission Corps. And they originally were formed to help make sure people who were coming into the United States were free of diseases and to treat people who came in with diseases like smallpox, like scurvy, after long times out at sea. And so our uniforms are actually Navy uniforms. And again, I'm not a general. The Surgeon General actually carries the rank of Vice Admiral, a 3-star admiral, because we often worked closely with the Navy, given that a lot of our work was centered around people who were at sea or coming in from at sea. And a lot of our focus early on was centered around infectious diseases, making sure they weren't spreading in the United States, making sure they weren't a threat to the United States. And it's interesting because what's old is new again. We're arguing now about immigration. We're arguing now about vaccine mandates and about public health authorities like quarantining. But, you know, the term quarantine actually traces back to the 14th century when the plague was going around and people were quarantined. It means 40 days on a boat or an island surrounded by guards to make sure they didn't actually develop the plague. So these discussions we're having are older than the United States, and the Public Health Service has been at the center of these conversations for over 200 years, being the doctors who actually are in charge of protecting America by preventing the spread of infectious disease, and in some cases working alongside our other military partners to enforce quarantine and to enforce isolation. So head of the Public Health Service Commission Corps is one job of the Surgeon General. It has also become, over the last 75 years or so of the job, more and more politically oriented. So the early Surgeons Generals would serve multiple administrations, would serve 10, 14, 16 years. Now it has become much more associated with the president who appoints you. And even though it's a 4-year term that can be extended, the last 20, 30 years, the Surgeon General has essentially been fired when a new president comes on board. And as such, one of the roles that you're seeing as having is advising the president in the administration, in addition to running the Public Health Service Commission Corps. The third job is the one that's the most visible and most associated with the Office of the Surgeon General, and that's being the nation's doctor. It's identifying issues such as smoking, such as alcohol misuse, such as skin cancer, in my case, such as the opioid epidemic, and helping the public understand their personal risk and the things that they can do to respond to that risk. So for me, when I became Surgeon General, the epidemic we were facing was an epidemic of opioid overdose deaths, a person dying every 10 to 11 minutes from an opioid overdose. And so one of the first things I did as Surgeon General was put out a call to action, the first one in over a decade from the Office of the Surgeon General, calling on more people to carry and be willing to administer naloxone. I'm very proud of that because when you look at the decline in opioid overdose deaths that is occurring right now after several years and you trace it back, it traces back to that time when we started to promote naloxone as a way to respond to an opioid overdose. And so that's the role of the Surgeon General in a nutshell: presidential advisor, head of the Public Health Service Commission Corps, and the nation's doctor, the guy on the side of the cigarette box, if you will, or on the side of your wine bottles.
Well said. You pointed out the opioid crisis, but your tenure as Surgeon General came with a number of really particularly difficult situations for our country. Beyond the opioid crisis, there were multiple natural disasters and a once in a generation, we hope, pandemic. Did these difficult situations change your view of the practice of medicine in the administration of public health in our nation?
Interesting question. We're talking to physician leaders today. So I think it's a great time to talk about leadership. You go into any leadership role, whether it's the Surgeon General or whether it's a CMO or whether it's a CEO, with an idea of what you want to accomplish in your time in that role. And one of the things that people say about leadership positions is that the days are long, but the years are short. And what I mean by that, for those who haven't heard that phrase, is these are incredibly difficult jobs, high stress jobs, and you literally are working in many cases 14, 16 hour days. But you blink and it's been 2 years, 3 years, your time is up. Because the average tenure in any leadership role, a high level leadership role nowadays, is only about 2 to 3 years. So it's important to remember that, because you do want to go in with an idea of what you want to accomplish and be very disciplined about that, because otherwise you'll blink and it'll be gone. That said, one of the other challenges that people don't often tell you about in these leadership roles is that you spend most of your days not working on the things that you had planned to work on, but you spend most of your days putting out fires. If you're a chief medical officer, you may have an idea about reforming the electronic health records in your system, or improving the processes, you know, a particular protocol or process in your hospital. But you end up having to deal with someone locking you out of your electronic health record and asking for a ransom. You end up dealing with problematic doctors, nurses, in situations that you weren't planning on dealing with, but it's a fire that you have to put out, and that can take up a lot of your time. So I'd say that's important to understand about leadership. Other things I learned about leadership as a physician, and this is a point that I make in my book Crisis and Chaos that I wrote about my time as Surgeon General, and that's that physicians, for better and for worse, we were trained that if someone asks you a question, you do your best to fully answer that question using the scientific method and a 40-slide PowerPoint presentation. And I say that a little bit tongue-in-cheek, but that's how we were trained. Unfortunately, that is not the best way to communicate with patients or with the media, particularly when you're in political positions. In many cases, they don't actually care what the answer to the question is. They have a different agenda, a different narrative they're trying to drive. And so what's the lesson there? The lesson there is that we need, I think, better communications training if we're going to be effective physician leaders, because the way that we're taught to communicate to one another as physicians, as health professionals, is not the way you most effectively communicate with policymakers, with even hospital administrators. How many times in my career have I argued something was best for the patient without realizing that I'm talking to a CFO, or I'm talking to, you know, someone who actually their goal isn't, at the end of the day, what's best for the individual patient. Their goal is what's best for the economic bottom line. And I don't mean that to say that people are putting profits over individuals, but if you're the CFO, you've got to balance the budget. And so I can't go to the CFO and say, this is best for the patient, without acknowledging that it's going to cost the hospital system lots of money. And so one of my leadership roles before I was Surgeon General or State Health Commissioner was as chair of the Pharmacy and Therapeutics Committee at our hospital. I was in that role for about 7 years. And it was during the time when the hepatitis C medications were coming onto the market. So I give this as an example because, great, we now have a cure for hepatitis C. We can prevent liver cancers. We can prevent many liver transplants. We can prevent severe morbidity and mortality in our patient population. As a physician, this is fantastic. But guess what? These drugs are going to cost $40,000, $50,000, $75,000 a person at the time. And I worked at a hospital where many of our patients did not have health insurance. So that money was going to come out of our bottom line. And so, yeah, you can cure one person's hepatitis C, but that $75,000 that you're spending is at the expense of investing in other resources, other patients that the hospital has a responsibility for. So understanding, again, who your audience and how to communicate to your audience in a way that actually moves them and helps them see where your interest and their interest align is something that I learned, again, not just as Surgeon General, not just as Health Commissioner, but being a physician leader in my own hospital.
That is such an important point and so often not discussed. Let's shift gears a little bit. Dr. Adams, do you believe that the public's trust in physicians has declined in recent years?
Absolutely. It's not just that I believe it. Study after study shows it. Trust in physicians, in hospitals, in institutions is at an all-time low. And I think that last point I made is what's critical. It's really mistrust in institutions that people have. And to the extent that we as physicians represent the institution of medicine, that's where people tend to mistrust us. Why is that distinction important? It is important because when you think about the terrible, terrible situation where the United Healthcare CEO was literally assassinated in downtown New York, and then you saw the public's reaction to that, really rallying behind the perpetrator, that shows you, again, that 99.9% of people did not know that individual and would not endorse the killing of an individual. But 99.9% of people have experienced problems with the healthcare system and saw that individual as being a representative of the a dysfunctional healthcare system. Two-thirds of bankruptcies are due to medical debt in the United States. Again, two-thirds of adults say that they have not taken their medications because of an inability to afford their medications. And so these frustrations with the healthcare system are manifesting in anger towards physicians. But, and this is an important but, the Gallup does a poll every year, and they ask people, who do you trust most when it comes to healthcare? And number one is nurses. Number two is doctors. Number three is pharmacists. But when you dig deeper, it's not writ large. It's actually their doctor, their nurse, their pharmacist. So to the people who are listening to us today, I want you to remember that there's a mistrust of the institutions that we are a part of, but there still remains a deep trust of us by our patients. And so we need to leverage that. We need to remember that when our patient is in front of us and we take on that role, that honored role of I am your doctor and here is what I recommend for you, it still does carry a significant amount of weight. The final point I'd make about trust, and it's one of the big points from my book, again, Crisis and Chaos, is that people need to know that you care before they care what you know. That's where a lot of the mistrust in institutions comes from, is that people don't think that these institutions care about them. They think that all they care about is making money or saving money. And so the trust that our patients have in us is because you're my doc. You've taken care of me for 20 years. You know me. And I believe that you genuinely care about me. So we need to, when we're meeting new patients and we're trying to convince people to do things that they might not otherwise want to do because we believe it's good for their health, we need to take the time to develop a relationship with them. We need to help them understand that we care about them as a person. And once that occurs, then all of a sudden, they'll be much more receptive to what we are asking them to do or what we're telling them that we know.
Over the past 30 years, we've seen a transformation in how physicians practice medicine. Gone are the small independent practices. Today, the vast majority of physicians work for an organization that's not even headed by a physician. Does this have implications, good or bad, for patients?
So we're talking about the fact that the majority of physicians no longer are working in solo practices or group practices, but are actually employed by systems. And to the point that we just made about institutions, we're becoming less seen as Dr. Adams and more seen as that person who works for healthcare system X. So in that system, in that sense, it is a negative because it's being harder and harder for us to be seen as that patient advocate, to be seen as my doctor. And along with that has come a change in practice. So once upon a time, the small town family practice doctor, I still remember my small town family practice doctor from when I was growing up, and I just turned 50 this year. His name is Dr. Bauer. And Dr. Bauer was, you know, no matter what, that he was on call. He was the person who was going to take care of you, who was going to call in your prescriptions, who was going to come see you in the hospital. Well, now that we're part of these institutions and work habits and expectations have changed, many millennials now, they want a five, or actually I was talking to a colleague yesterday, they want a 4-day work week, which means, you know, and they want shift work. They want to come in at time X and leave at time Y, whether the patient needs you to stay longer or not. And I'm not saying that to criticize healthcare workforce, but we do have to understand that now it's no longer Dr. Bauer. It's whatever doctor is working for MedStar Health System happens to be on call or working at that time. And that separation that occurs it creates a gap that makes it harder for us to build that trust. So that's one way in which it is bad. Another way it is bad is that it's becoming harder and harder for physicians to advocate for themselves. And we're also seeing membership. I talked about professional societies as being an important training ground for me early on. We're seeing membership in professional societies and healthcare professional societies is waning, is struggling, because now you no longer have an individual physician who wants this professional society to fight for their salary, to fight for their malpractice reform, to fight for the things that are important to them as an individual. You're now an employee of a system. And it's not my problem anymore. It's the healthcare system's problem to deal with that. It is the attitude. So you're seeing a big change in culture, expectations, and relationships because of what is going on. And that said, many people now, millennials, you know, and all the other ennials that are out there, because we're now into the next generation of folks who are becoming doctors, they have a much greater emphasis on work-life balance. And so they perceive their day-to-day lives to be better than what they saw in their parents, their grandparents, the people who came before them who were doctors, who were always on call, who never felt like they could take a vacation, who in many cases experienced divorces and difficulties with their own families because they were always having to put their patients first. And so there's good and bad to what's going on right now. I think what I really would emphasize people to focus on is not categorizing these things into good or bad, overall, but really saying, okay, what are the negatives that are coming out of this in terms of physician advocacy, in terms of connections with patients, and how do we mitigate those? What are the upsides in terms of this change, in terms of better work-life balance? And those sorts of things, and how do we emphasize and scale up the good while recognizing and addressing the bad?
Very interesting. Dr. Adams, it seems to me that in this country there's a tension between a citizen's individual freedoms and a citizen's civic or communal duties. As a public health leader, how do you find a balance here?
Well, once again, this is a question that raises its head from time to time throughout history, but it's not anything new. You go back 100 years ago, the flu pandemic of 1918, there were fights over masking. There were fights over vaccinations, public good versus individual good. I do think, this is inarguable, we are in a moment in the history of the United States and in many ways the history of the planet where there is a mistrust of institutions. We've been in these moments before, but we are in a moment like that now. We're in a moment where folks very much are leaning into me versus we. And again, we've been there before, but we are in that moment now. And I say that because it's important for us to understand historically, we've been here before and we will get through this. So it's not going to be the end of the world or of society as we know it. But we also need to look at, okay, what were some of the things that helped us get through those moments in the past? And that's acknowledging the real concerns, issues that individuals felt. I hate when people make comparisons to World War II because it's always hyperbole. Mm. But when you think back to a lot of why the German population, when you study history, were willing to embrace some of the things that happened during World War II, it was because they were so horribly mistreated or felt so horribly mistreated and neglected and put upon after World War I. And so I say that not to excuse anyone or anything, but to say that when people feel put upon, when they feel like folks are not willing to listen to them, they are far more likely to embrace ideas and concepts that they might not have before, and they're far more willing to buy into it's me against the world, it's my group against the world type of mentality. And what we have to do is really do a better job of again showing people that we care about them, not buying into the us versus them rhetoric. And recognizing the real frustration, the real pain, the real harm, the real financial difficulties that folks are going through, and acknowledge that. A great example to put it into a conversation that's going on right now is vaccine hesitancy. And I will often say, you are rarely going to shame someone into getting vaccinated. And even if you do, you're likely to lose their trust moving forward in a way that's going to hurt you long term. Behind every person who makes a choice not to get vaccinated, if you dig deep enough, there is almost always a story of an encounter they had with the healthcare system that was negative, that caused them to mistrust the healthcare system. And if instead of taking the time to ascertain why, and to uncover that story, and to validate the frustration that those individuals feel, you shame and blame them, then you're just going to cause them to double down. Yeah, I was right. I was right to mistrust the system, and you prove it by the way that you treated me. And so that's a long way of getting around to the point, again, that people need to know that you care before they care what you know. And yes, mistrust and it's being fed by misinformation and disinformation is a real public health crisis right now. But the way that we overcome that is by being better communicators, better listeners, and really making the effort to help people understand that we care about them and what we're doing to address their concerns.
Your answer leads me to the next question. And when preparing to speak today, I came across a quote of yours. At least it was reported several weeks ago that you said, "While I typically try to focus on policies over personalities, it has become necessary to directly address the role of Robert F. Kennedy as head of HHS. Could you please address that role and Secretary Kennedy's actions at HHS?
Well, again, I said you rarely win in the short term or the long term by shaming, blaming, or attacking people. And Robert F. Kennedy, he became the head of health for the United States in many ways because a lot of folks out there feel like the system is failing them and want someone to come in and shake up that system. If someone doesn't feel like they're welcome in the house, they don't mind burning the house down. And in many ways, we're seeing that. Additionally, I've also said that I support a lot of the tenets of the MAHA movement and what RFK has espoused. When you talk about better nutrition and better food, when you talk about physical activity. However, that has also come not with a side dish, but with a main course of vaccine hesitancy and skepticism. And so I have tried to speak about policies of this current administration and current iteration of HHS, while not attacking individuals. Because as I mentioned, when you attack the individual, it's easy for people to say, "Oh, well, you're just being political, or you just don't like RFK, or you've got something out for him." And so I've tried to avoid it. But that said, he is the head of health for the United States of America. And he is making unilateral decisions, which in many cases are harming public trust and the public. And so a concrete example in what the quote you talk about relates back to his decision, his unprecedented unilateral decision to disband all 17 members of the Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices, a group of objective, vetted people with expertise that dates back to 1964. And as HHS secretary, he chose to fire all 17 members, replace them with members who have quite a number of conflicts of interest in terms of profiting off of vaccine misinformation and hesitancy, and who are lacking in the expertise that is necessary to have a full and fulsome conversation about the pros and cons of different vaccine recommendations, and who don't seem to understand the implications of putting something on the vaccine schedule or not. It's in many ways a determinant of whether or not things will be available to parents and to children at a state level. It can determine insurance coverage of different vaccines, in addition to the trust issues. And so at the last ACIP meeting, they spent a substantial amount of time talking about thimerosal in a presentation that was led by someone who has previously been the head of an organization that spread vaccine misinformation. And they also pulled down, without any explanation as to why, a CDC report that explained the safety of thimerosal over the years. And so to answer your question, when a single individual is making decisions which are harmful to health, you reach a point where you have no choice but to address that head on and to talk about the decisions that that individual is making and hopefully lead to a conversation about why that individual is making those decisions and what we can do to protect our patients and the health of our society moving forward. So again, I don't know RFK Jr. I can't say personally what his motives are, but I can speak to the things that he is doing in this very important role and point out how they are harming and will continue to harm public health and public trust. We have a measles outbreak in Texas that's now spread to multiple states, over 1,200 cases, two children dead from this measles outbreak. And yet at the ACIP meeting, we didn't have a conversation. We didn't have a vote on the MMRV vaccine because we were spending our time debating settled science on thimerosal. The priorities that he chooses to focus on as an individual, as HHS secretary, have a direct result on the health and safety of our nation. And right now, I see that going in a negative direction based on what he's choosing to prioritize and the action and the ways he's choosing to exert his authority.
Maybe you could talk a little bit more about your short-term and long-term public health concerns for our country, whether they relate to the current administration or otherwise.
One thing I will start off with here is emphasizing the positives of things that RFK has lifted up in some ways. 71% of the U.S. adult population is overweight or obese. And so we absolutely need to recognize that as a public health crisis because obesity leads to high blood pressure, cardiovascular disease, kidney disease, cancer, diabetes. It is a public health crisis. And in many ways, it's a public health crisis fueled by our food supply and the makeup of our communities. That said, like I said, RFK Jr. has spent far more time in his tenure as HHS secretary so far addressing and tearing down decades-long vaccine infrastructure and trust. And then he has focusing on our obesity epidemic and our problems with nutrition and physical activity. So I worry about that as he does moving forward, but I'm not seeing the emphasis. I'm not seeing him walking the talk when it comes to focusing on those issues. Vaccine mistrust, again, is a major public health concern. And as I have often said, this is another quote some of you may have heard from me. You can't die from diabetes when you're 50 if you've already died from diphtheria when you're 5. And so everything that we do in terms of promoting health and wellness in this country has been and has to be built on a strong foundation of vaccine confidence and vaccine uptake. And I say this from personal experience. I have been a state health commissioner when we've had outbreaks of vaccine preventable diseases. And I can tell you that just as I talked about in a leadership role, you can spend more of your time putting out fires than you ever imagined. Get a couple of measles outbreaks in your state, and you'll spend so much of your time doing outbreak investigation and dealing with that you won't have any time to focus on your other priorities. When I was health commissioner, my priority was focusing on infant mortality. But we had a measles outbreak at the Super Bowl in Indianapolis, and we're chasing that down. We had tuberculosis outbreaks, and you can't prevent tuberculosis right now with a vaccine. But one of the other things we're seeing this administration do is cut CDC funding and staffing, cut NIH funding and staffing, cut FDA funding and staffing. And that's going to impact our ability to come up with new treatments for diseases. It's going to impact our ability to do surveillance and understand where problems are occurring so that we can stop those, nip those problems in the bud. It's going to hurt our ability to actually be able to respond to outbreaks and to other problems when they occur. So I'm very concerned about, like I said, our obesity and chronic disease epidemic and our continued failure to address it. I'm concerned about an epidemic of infectious diseases that we are creating, if you will, and an epidemic of mistrust around infectious disease prevention and control that is being created by the current climate. And I'm terribly concerned about the tearing down of public health and scientific infrastructure that is going to set us up for harm for decades, potentially generations in the future.
Well said. Dr. Adams, you've spent years in public service at both the state and federal level. Does public service make you a better physician?
I think public service. So the answer to your question, I've given you long-winded answers to every question. Let me give you a short one. Yes. I think that America has been built on people willing to step up and put their society, their community, their country above themselves. It's literally what we are founded on, and it's what really concerns me about this moment we're in, where it's all about me, 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 me. And so you asked about making you a better physician. I actually think it makes you a better person. If I were ever in charge, and I want to reassure folks on here, I have no plans to run for office because I've seen the challenges that that folks who run for office face in terms of attacks on themselves and their families. But that said, if I were ever in a position of authority to do something like this, I've lived in Europe. I've lived in other countries where they have compulsory public service in some way, shape, or form, whether it's mandatory military service or mandatory service in some other way. And it engenders a sense of community. It gives you a perspective that you might not have otherwise had, because you're working alongside other people who are unlikely to come from the same environments that you come from. And so I believe public service actually makes you a better person. Whether you're a physician, whether you're a lawyer, whether you're a business owner, no matter who or what you are. And I worry about this world getting to a place where fewer and fewer people are willing to be public servants, because then that means the voices represented at the table are becoming more and more isolated and less representative. So to anyone listening who considered public service, and again, there are many ways to serve your public. You can run for office. You can support someone who's running for office. You can be an appointed individual. You can serve on a board or commission. No matter the state you're in, there are literally hundreds, in many cases, thousands of different boards and commissions you can serve on. You can work on your local school board. So there's you can be on your neighborhood association that helps determine whether or not you're going to put sidewalks in your community. So literally, without leaving your own neighborhood, you can be involved in public service, all the way up to running for office and being a senator or a congressman or being Surgeon General of the United States. So many ways you can give back. And my own my call to arms for the people listening is to find a way in which that works for you and where you are in your life to serve the public. But don't think that, again, it has to be this big, I'm going to commit my life to running for Senate or running for president in order to change the world. We change the world on, one little bit at a time and by all doing our part.
What a fabulous answer. Unfortunately, our time together is up. I'd really like to talk to you for the rest of the day. My guest has been Jerome Adams. His book is Crisis and Chaos. Dr. Adams, first and foremost, thank you for your service to our country. Thank you also for being on Sound Practice.
Thank you. It's been a great conversation. I really appreciate it. And a reminder to folks, we've been through worse before. We will come out of this, but the only way to come out of it with minimal harm is for us to all do our part and for us all to see one another as fellow man, fellow woman, fellow citizen, and not as as the enemy. And if we do that, I think we'll engender more trust in the healthcare system and in our institutions, and we'll leave a better future for our children.
Hear, hear, spoken like a true physician leader. Thank you, Dr. Adams.
Thank you.
My thanks to Jerome Adams. Dr. Adams has served his state, nation, and profession with distinction. His actions have benefited and continue to benefit millions of our fellow Americans. He is a true physician leader. My thanks also to the American Association for Physician Leadership for making this podcast possible. Please join me next time on Sound Practice. We release a new episode every other Wednesday.
You've been listening to Sound Practice, the business podcast for physicians and healthcare leaders. Check out the show notes for this episode at soundpractice.com. If you have any suggestions for future episodes, we'd love to hear them. Email us at info@soundpractice.com. Subscribe to Sound Practice wherever you listen to podcasts so you can automatically receive our episodes. And please rate us and comment on the podcast in iTunes and Google Play. Sound Practice is presented and produced by the team at American Association for Physician Leadership. We are the world's premier organization for all aspects of physician leadership in every sector of healthcare. Learn more at physicianleaders.org. That man Robin, Whitman Kapow.